He's thrown his tweed coat over the back of the chair, and with shirt sleeves rolled up to his forearms, he's proofing manuscript pages with a red pen that looks tiny in his fist.
"Why are they here?" he demands.
"Give me the blueprint," Paul says, coming right to the point. Taft looks at Charlie, then at me.
"Sit down," he says,
pointing toward a pair of chairs with two thick fingers. I glance around, trying to ignore him. Wooden bookshelves line the tiny office on all sides, covering the white walls. Trails run through the dust on their surfaces, where volumes have been dragged off to be read. There's a path worn in the carpet, where Taft walks from the door to his desk.
"Sit," Taft repeats.
Paul is about to refuse when Charlie nudges him into the chair, wanting to get this over with. Taft balls a rag in his hand and wipes his mouth with it.
"Tom Sullivan,"
he says, the resemblance finally occurring to him. I nod, but say nothing. There's an old pillory on the wall above his head, mounted with its jaws open. The only hint of light or color in the room is the red morocco of bookbindings and the gold of gilt pages. "Leave him alone," Paul says, sitting forward. "Where's the blueprint?" I'm surprised how strong he sounds. Taft tuts, bringing a cup of tea to his mouth. There's an unpleasant look in his eyes, as if he's waiting for one of us to put up a fight. Finally, he rises from the leather chair, forces the sleeves of his shirt up higher, and plods over to a space in the bookshelves where a safe has been built into the wall. He spins the combination with a hairy hand, then pulls the lever and swings the door on its hinges. Reaching inside, he produces a leather notebook.
"Is that it?" Paul says faintly.
When Taft opens it and hands something to Paul, though, it's only a typed piece of Institute stationery dated 2 weeks ago.
"I want you to know where things stand," Taft says. "Read it."
When I see the effect the paper has on Paul, I lean over to read it as well.
"Dean Meadows, pursuant to our conversation of 12 March regarding Paul Harris, herewith the additional information you requested. As you know, Mr. Harris petitioned for several extensions and has been highly secretive concerning the content of his work. Only when, at my insistence, he submitted a final progress report last week did I understand why. Enclosed, please find a copy of my upcoming article, Unveiling the Mystery, Francesco Colonna and the Hypnerata Machia Polyphili, tentatively scheduled for fall publication in Renaissance Quarterly. Also enclosed is a copy of Mr. Harris's progress report for the purposes of comparison. Please contact me with any further inquiries. Sincerely, Dr. Vincent Taft."
We're speechless. The ogre turns to Charlie and me.
"I've worked on this for 30 years, he says, a strange evenness in his voice. "Now the results don't even bear my name. You have never been grateful to me, Paul. Not when I introduced you to Stephen Gelbman. Not when you received special access to the rare books room. Not even when I granted you multiple extensions on your ineffectual work. Never."
Paul is too stunned to respond.
"I won't have you take this from me," Taft continues. "I've waited too long."
"They have my other progress reports," Paul stutters. "They have Bill's records."
"They've never seen a progress report from you," Taft says, opening a drawer and pulling out a sheaf of forms. "And they certainly don't have Bill's records."
"They'll know it wasn't yours. You haven't published anything on Francesco in 25 years. You don't even work on the Hypnerata Machia anymore."
Taft pulls at his beard. "Renaissance Quarterly has seen 3 preliminary drafts of my article, and I've received several calls of congratulation on my lecture last night."
Remembering the dates on Stein's letters, I see the long provenance of this idea. The months of suspicion between Stein and Taft over who'd steal Paul's research first. "But he has his conclusions," I say, when it doesn't seem to dawn on Paul. "He hasn't told anyone." I expect Taft to react badly, but he seems amused.
"Conclusion so soon, Paul," he says. "To what do we attribute this sudden success?"
He knows about the diary.
"You let Bill find it," Paul says.
"You still don't know what he found," I insist.
"And you," Taft says, turning to me, "are as deluded as your father was. If a boy can puzzle out the meaning of that diary, you think I can't?"
Paul is dazed, eyes darting around the room. "My father thought you were a fool," I say.
"Your father died waiting for a muse to whisper in his ear."
He laughs. "Scholarship is rigor, not inspiration. He never listened to me, and he suffered for it. He was right about that book. You were wrong." Hatred dances in Taft's eyes.
"I know what he did, boy. You shouldn't be so proud."
I glance over at Paul, not understanding, but he's taken several steps away from the desk, toward the bookshelf. Taft leans forward.
"Can you blame him? Failed? Disgraced? The rejection of his book was the coup de grace."
I turn back, thunderstruck.
"And he did it with his own son in the car," Taft continues. "How pregnant."
"It was an accident," I say. Taft smiles, and there are 1,000 teeth in it. I step toward him. Charlie puts a hand against my chest, but I shake it off. Taft slowly rises from his chair.
"You did it to him,"
I say, vaguely aware that I'm shouting. Charlie's hand is on me again, but I pull away, stepping forward until the edge of the desk is knifing into my scar. Taft turns the corner, bringing himself into reach.
"He's goading you, Tom," Paul says quietly from across the room.
"He did it to himself," Taft says.
And the last thing I remember before pushing him as hard as I can is the smile on his face. He falls, the weight of him collapsing onto itself, and there's a thunder I feel in the floorboards. Everything seems to splinter, voices shouting, sights blurring, and Charlie's hands are on me again, yanking me back.
"Come on," he says.
I try to jerk free, but Charlie's grip is stronger.
"Come on," he repeats to Paul, who's still staring at Taft on the floor.
But it's too late. Taft staggers to his feet, then lumbers toward me.
"Stay away from him," Charlie says, extending a hand in Taft's direction.
Taft glares at me from across the span of Charlie's arms. Paul is looking around the room, oblivious to them, searching for something. Finally, Taft's senses return, and he reaches for the phone. A stab of fear registers on Charlie's face.
"Let's go," he says, stepping back.
"Now!" Taft punches three numbers, ones Charlie has seen too often to mistake.
"Police," he says, staring directly at me. "Please come immediately. I'm being attacked in my office."
Charlie is pushing me out the door.
"Go," he says.
Just then, Paul darts over to the open safe and pulls out the balance of what remains inside. Then he starts pulling papers and books from the shelves, uprooting bookends, turning over everything in his reach. When he's got a pile of Taft's papers in hand, he backs away and dashes out the door without so much as a glance at Charlie or me. We bolt after him. The last thing I hear from the office is the sound of Taft on the phone, announcing our names to the police. His voice carries through the open door, echoing down the hallway. We dart through the corridor to the dark cellar stairs when a rush of cold descends from overhead. Two campus police officers have arrived at the foot of the steps on the ground floor above us.
"Stay right there,"
one of them calls down the narrow staircase. We stop short.
"Campus police, don't move!"
Paul is looking over my shoulder toward the far end of the hall, clutching the papers in his left hand.
"Do what they say," Charlie tells him.
But I know what's caught Paul's eye. There's a janitor's closet down there. Inside is an entrance to the tunnels. It's not safe down there, Charlie says under his breath, edging toward Paul to keep him from running. They're doing construct... The Proctors mistake the movement for flight, and one comes barreling down the stairs just as Paul makes for the door.
Stop, the Proctor cries. Don't go in there!
But Paul is already at the entrance, pulling the wood panel open. He disappears inside. Charlie doesn't hesitate. Before either of the cops knows it, he's two steps ahead, moving fast toward the door. I hear a thud as he jumps to the tunnel floor, trying to stop Paul. Then his voice, shouting Paul's name, echoes up from below.
Come out,
the Proctor booms, nudging me forward. The officer leans in and calls again, but only silence follows.
Call it in,
the first one begins to say, when a thunderous noise comes roaring up from the tunnels, and the boiler room beside us begins to hiss. Immediately, I know what's happened. A steam pipe has burst. And now, I can hear Charlie screaming. In an instant, I'm at the threshold of the janitor's closet. The manhole is pure darkness, so I take a wild leap. When I hit the ground, adrenaline is forking through me, live as lightning, and the pain from landing fades before it spreads. I force myself up. Charlie's moaning in the distance, leading me toward him, even as the Proctor yells overhead. One of the officers has the sense to realize what's going on.
We're calling an ambulance, he calls into the tunnel. Can you hear me?
I'm moving through a soupy mist. The heat intensifies, but the only thing on my mind is Charlie. For seconds at a time, the hiss of the pipe drowns out everything else. Charlie's groans are clearer now. I push forward, trying to get to him. Finally, at a turn in the pipes, I find him. He's buckled over himself, motionless. His clothes are ragged and his hair is matted to his head. In the distance, as my eyes adjust, I can see a gaping hole in a barrel-sized pipe near the floor. Charlie groans. I don't understand. I realize he's trying to say my name. His chest is soaked. The steam hit him right in the gut. Can you stand? I ask, trying to put his arm around my shoulder. He mumbles, losing consciousness. Clenching my teeth, I try lifting him, but it's like trying to move a mountain. Come on, Charlie, I plead, jerking him up a little. Don't fade on me. But I sense I'm talking to less and less of him. There's more and more dead weight.
Help!
I bark into the distance.
Please help me!
There are gashes in his shirt where the pressure shredded the fabric, soaking him to the skin. I can hardly feel him breathing. He gurgles, trying to curl a finger around my hand. I grab his shoulders and shake him again. Finally, I hear footsteps. A beam of light knifes through the fog, and I can see a medic, two of them, rushing toward me. In a second, they're close enough for me to see their faces. But when the beams of their flashlights finally cross Charlie's body, I can hear one of them say, "Oh, Jesus." "Are you hurt?" the other says to me, patting at my chest with his hands. I stare back at him, uncomprehending. Then, as I look down at the circle of my stomach lit by his flashlight, I understand. The water sprayed across Charlie's chest wasn't water at all. I'm covered in his blood. Both of the EMTs are with him now, trying to raise him up. A third medic arrives and tries to move me, but I fight him off, trying to stay at Charlie's side. Slowly, I feel myself beginning to slip away. In the heat and the darkness, I'm losing my hold on reality. A pair of hands guides me out of the tunnels, and I see the two officers with two other policemen behind them now, all watching as the ambulance team drags me above ground. The last thing I remember is the look on the Proctor's face as he stands there, watching me rise from the darkness, bloody from my face to the tips of my fingers. At first, he looks relieved to see me stumble out of the wreckage. Then his expression changes, and the relief disappears from his eyes as he realizes the blood isn't mine. Chapter 20. I come to my senses in a bed at Princeton Medical Center, several hours after the accident. Paul is sitting beside me, glad to see me awake, and a policeman is standing outside the door. Someone has changed me into a paper gown that crunches like a diaper when I sit up. There's blood beneath my fingernails, dark as dirt, and there's a familiar smell in the air, something I remember from my old hospital past. The smell of sickness mopped over with disinfectant. The smell of medicine. Tom, Paul says. I prop myself up to face him, but pain shoots through my arm. Careful, he says, leaning over. The doctor says you injured your shoulder. Now, as I'm becoming more aware, I can feel pain beneath the bandage. What happened to you down there? It was stupid. I just reacted. I couldn't get back to Charlie once the pipe exploded. All of the steam was coming in my direction. I came back through the nearest exit, and the police drove me here. Where's Charlie? In the emergency room. They won't let anyone see him.
His voice has gone flat. After rubbing at his eyes, he glances out the door. An old woman skids past in a wheelchair, nimble as a kid in a go-kart. The cop watches her, but doesn't smile. There's a little yellow sandwich board on the tile floor that says, "Caution, wet surface."
Is he okay? I ask.
Paul keeps his eyes on the door.
I don't know. Will said he was right beside the broken pipe when they found him.
Will?
Will Clay, Charlie's friend.
Paul places a hand on the rail of the bed.
He pulled you out.
I try to think back, but all I remember are silhouettes in the tunnels, lit up around the edges by flashlights.
He and Charlie switched shifts when you guys went looking for me, Paul adds.
There's a great sadness in his voice. He traces this all back to himself.
Do you want me to call Katie and tell her you're here? He asks.
I shake my head, wanting to feel more grounded first.
I'll call her later.
The old woman rolls past a second time, and now I spot the cast on her left leg, running from her knee to her toes. Her hair is mussed and her pants are rolled up above the knee, but there's a twinkle in her eyes, and she gives the officer a defiant smile when she passes by, as if it's a law she's broken rather than a bone. Charlie told me once that geriatric patients are relieved sometimes to take a little fall or have a minor illness. Losing a battle reminds them that they're still winning the war. I'm struck suddenly by Charlie's absence, by the emptiness where I expect to hear his voice.
He must have lost a lot of blood, I say.
Paul looks at his hands. In the silence, I can hear wheezing across the partition between my bed and the next. Just then, a doctor enters the room. The officer at the door touches the elbow of her white lab coat, and when she stops, the two of them exchange quiet words.
Thomas, she says, coming to the bedside with a clipboard and a frown.
Yes?
I'm Dr. Jansen.
She walks to the opposite side of the bed to examine my arm.
How are you feeling?
Fine. How's Charlie doing?
She prods my shoulder a little, just enough to make me squirm.
I don't know. He's been in the ER since he got here.
I'm not clear-headed enough to know what it means that she recognizes Charlie by his first name.
Will he be okay? It's too early to tell, she says, without looking up.
When can we see him?
Paul asks.
One thing at a time, she says, placing a hand between my back and the pillow, then raising me up.
How does this feel?
Fine.
And this? She presses two fingers over my collarbone.
Fine.
The poking continues across my back, elbow, wrist, and head. She tries the stethoscope for good measure, then finally sits back. Doctors are like gamblers, always looking for the right combinations.
Patients are like slot machines. Twist their arms long enough and you're bound to hit the jackpot. You're lucky it wasn't worse, she says. There's no fracture, but the soft tissue is bruised. You'll feel it when the painkiller wears off. Ice it twice a day for a week, then you'll have to come back so we can take another look. She has an earthy smell to her, like sweat and soap. I wait for her to pull out a prescription pad, remembering the cabinet of drugs I collected after the car accident, but she doesn't. There's someone outside who'd like to talk to you, she tells me instead. For a second, because she says it so pleasantly, I imagine a friend out in the hall. Gil, maybe, returned from the eating clubs, or even my mother, flown in from Ohio. Suddenly, I'm unsure how much time has passed since they dragged me out of the ground. But a different face appears in the doorway, one I've never seen before. Another woman, but not a doctor, and definitely not my mother. She's heavy-set and short, tucked into a round black skirt down to her calves and opaque black stockings. A white blouse and red suit jacket give her a maternal air, but my first thought is that she's a university administrator. The doctor and the woman exchange a look, then switch places, one leaving as the other comes. The black-stockinged woman stops short of the bed and makes a gesture to Paul, beckoning him over. They have a conversation out of earshot. Then, unexpectedly, he asks if I'm okay, waits for me to nod, and walks out with another man standing near the door. Officer, the woman says, would you close that behind you? To my surprise, he nods and shuts the door, leaving us alone. The woman waddles over to the bedside, pausing to glance at the bed beyond the curtain. How are you feeling, Tom? She sits down in the chair where Paul was, making it disappear. She has squirrely cheeks. When she talks, they seem full of nuts. Not so good, I say warily. I tilt my right side toward her, showing her the bandage. Can I get you anything? No, thanks. My son was here last month, she says absently, searching for something in her jacket pocket. Appendectomy. I'm just about to ask who she is when she pulls a little leather wallet out of her breast pocket. Tom, I'm Detective Gwynn. I'd like to talk to you about what happened today. She unfolds the wallet to show me her badge, then flips it back in her pocket. Where's Paul? Speaking with Detective Martin. I'd like to ask you some questions about William Stein. Do you know who he was? He died last night. He was killed. She lets a silence punctuate the last word. Did any of your roommates know him? Paul did. They worked together at the Institute for Advanced Study. She pulls a steno pad from her jacket pocket. Do you know Vincent Taft? Sort of, I say, sensing something bigger on the horizon. Did you go to his office earlier today? Pressure is building in my temples. Why? Did you get into a fight with him? I wouldn't call it a fight. She makes a note. Were you and your roommate in the museum last night? She asks, rummaging through a file in her hand. The question seems to have a thousand outcomes. I think back. Paul covered his hands with his shirt cuffs when he touched Stein's letter. No one could have seen our faces in the dark. No. The detective rolls her lips the way some women even their lipstick. I can't read her body language. Finally, she produces a sheet of paper from the folder and passes it to me. It's a photocopy of the login sheet Paul and I signed for the museum guard. The date and time are stamped beside each entry. How did you get into the museum library? Paul had the punch code, I say, giving up. He got it from Bill Stein. Stein's desk was part of our crime scene. What were you looking for? I don't know. The detective gives me a sympathetic look. I think your friend Paul, she says, is getting you into more trouble than you realize. I wait for her to give it a name, something legal, but she doesn't. Instead, she says, it's your name on this security sheet, isn't it? She lifts the paper, taking it back. And you're the one who assaulted Dr. Taft. I didn't... Odd that your friend Charlie was the one who tried to resuscitate William Stein. Charlie's a medic, but where was Paul Harris? For a moment, the facade disappears. A curtain rises over her eyes, and the gentle matron is gone. You need to start looking out for yourself, Tom. I can't tell if it's a threat or a caution. Your friend Charlie is in the same boat, she says, if he pulls through this. She waits, letting it sink in. Just tell me the truth. I did. Paul Harris left the auditorium before Dr. Taft's lecture was over. Yes. He knew where Stein's office was. They worked together, yes. It was his idea to break into the art museum. He had keys. We didn't break in. And it was his idea to go through Stein's desk. I know better than to keep responding. There are no right answers now. He ran from the campus police outside of Dr. Taft's office, Tom. Why would he do that? But she wouldn't understand and doesn't want to. I know where this is heading, but all I can think of is what she said about Charlie. If he pulls through this. He's a straight-A student, Tom. That's his identity here. Then Dr. Taft found out about the plagiarism. Who do you suppose told Taft? Brick by brick, as if it's just a matter of building a wall between friends. William Stein, she says, knowing I've passed the point of helping her. Imagine how Paul felt. How angry would he have been? Suddenly, a knock comes at the door. Before either of us can say a word, it swings open. Detective, says another officer. What is it? There's someone out here to talk to you. Who? He glances down at a card in his hand. A dean from the college. The detective remains seated for a second, then rises toward the door. There's a tight silence after she leaves. After long enough, when she doesn't return, I sit up in bed looking around for my shirt. I've had enough of hospitals, and I'm well enough to nurse this arm myself. I want to see Charlie. I want to know what they've said to Paul. My jacket is hanging from the coat rack, and I begin to shift my weight gingerly to get out of bed. Just then, the knob shifts and the door swishes open. Detective Gwynne returns. You're free to go, she says abruptly. The dean's office will be contacting you. I can only wonder what happened out there. The woman hands me her card and looks at me closely. But I want you to think about what I said, Tom. I nod. There seems to be something more she'd like to add, but she holds her tongue. Without another word, she turns around and leaves. When the door shuts, another hand reaches in to push it open. I freeze, waiting for the dean to enter. But this time, it's a friendly face. Gil has arrived, and he's bearing gifts. In his left hand is exactly what I need right now. A clean change of clothes. You okay? He asks. Yeah. What's going on? I got a call from Will Clay. He told me what happened. How's your shoulder? Fine. Did he say anything about Charlie? A little bit. Is he okay? Better than when he got here. There's something to the way Gil says it. What's wrong? I ask. Nothing, Gil says finally. The cops talked to you? Yeah. Paul, too. Did you see him out there? He's in the waiting room. Richard Curry's with him. I fumble out of bed. He is? Why? Gil shrugs, eyeing the hospital food. Need some help? With what? Getting dressed. I'm not sure if he's kidding. I think I can handle it. He smiles as I struggle to peel off the hospital gown. Let's check on Charlie, I say, getting used to my own feet again. But now he hesitates. What's wrong? An odd look comes over him, embarrassed and angry at the same time. He and I got into it pretty deep last night, Tom.
I know. I mean, after you and Paul left, I said some things I shouldn't have. I remember how clean the room was this morning. This is why Charlie didn't sleep. It doesn't matter, I say. Let's go see him. He wouldn't want to see me right now. Of course he would. Gil runs a finger beneath his nose, then says, The doctors don't want him disturbed anyway. I'll come back later. He pulls his keys out of his pocket, and there's something sad in his eyes. Finally, he puts a hand on the doorknob. Give me a call at Ivy if you need anything, he says, and when the door slides open, silent on its hinges, he steps out into the hallway. The officer is gone, and even the old woman in her wheelchair is nowhere to be seen. Someone has taken the yellow sandwich board away. I wait for Gil to look back, but he doesn't. Before I can say another word, he turns the corner toward the exit and is gone. Charlie described to me once what epidemics did to human relationships in past centuries. How diseases made men shun the infected and fear the healthy, until parents and children wouldn't sit at the same table with each other, and the whole body politic began to rot. You don't get sick if you stay to yourself, I told him, sympathizing with those who took to the hills. Then Charlie looked at me, and in 10 words made the best argument in favor of doctors that I've ever heard, which I think applies equally well to friendships. Maybe not, he said, but you don't get well that way either. The feeling I got watching Gil leave, the one that made me think of what Charlie said, is the same one I feel as I walk into the waiting room and find Paul sitting by himself. We're each alone in this now, and for the worse. Paul cuts an odd figure there, solitary in a row of white plastic seats, holding his head as he stares at the floor. It's supposed he always strikes when he's deep in thought, leaning over with his fingers wrapped behind the base of his skull, both elbows on his knees. More nights than I can remember, I've woken up to find him sitting at his desk that way, a pen between his fingers, an old lamp casting light over the pages of his notebook. My first instinct thinking of that is to ask him what he found in the diary. Even after everything that's happened, I want to know. I want to help. I want to remind him of an old partnership so that he doesn't feel alone. But seeing him bent over the way he is, fighting with himself over an idea, I know better. I have to remember how he slaved over his thesis after I left, how many mornings he came to breakfast with red eyes, how many nights we brought him cups of black coffee from the Wawa. If someone could count the sacrifices he made for Colonna's book, put a number to them the way a prisoner scratches marks on a wall, they'd dwarf what little sweat of mine I've added to the balance. Partnership is what he wanted months ago, when I refused to give it. All I can offer now is my company. Hey, I say quietly, walking over to his side. Tom, he says, standing. His eyes are bloodshot. You okay? I ask. He rubs a sleeve across his face. Yeah, how about you? I'm okay. He looks at my arm. It'll be fine, I say. Before I can tell him about Gil, a young doctor with a thin beard steps into the waiting room. Is Charlie okay? Paul asks. Watching the doctor, I feel a ghost impact, like standing at the tracks as a train hurtles by. He's wearing light green scrubs, the same color as the walls of the hospital where I did my rehabilitation after the accident. A bitter-looking color, like olives mashed with limes. The physical therapist told me to stop looking down, that I'd never learn to walk again if I couldn't stop staring at the pins in my leg. Look forward, she said, always forward. So I stared at the green of the walls. His condition is stable, says the man in scrubs. Stable, I think, a doctor's word. For 2 days after they stopped the bleeding in my leg, I was stable. It just meant that I was dying less quickly than before. Can we see him? Paul asks. No, the man says. Charlie's still unconscious.
Paul hesitates, as if unconscious and stable ought to be mutually exclusive. Is he going to be okay?
The doctor comes up with a look, something gentle but certain, and says, I think the worst is over. Paul smiles faintly at the man, then thanks him. I don't tell Paul what it really means. In the emergency room, they're washing their hands and mopping the floors, waiting for the next gurney off the ambulance. The worst is over. For the doctors. For Charlie. It's just begun.
Thank God, Paul says, almost to himself.
And looking at him now, watching the way relief sets over his face, I realize something. I never believed that Charlie would die from what happened down there. I never believed that he could. Paul doesn't say much as I check myself out, except to mumble something about the cruelty of what Taft said to me at his office. There's hardly any paperwork to complete, just a form or two to sign, a campus ID to flash, and as I struggle to write my name with my bad hand, I sense that the dean has been here already, smoothing out the wrinkles in advance. I wonder again what she told the detective to get the two of us released. Then I remember what Gil told me. Curry was here?
He left just before you got out. He didn't look good.
Why not?
He was wearing the same suit he wore last night.
He knew about Bill?
Yeah. It was almost like he thought...
Paul lets the thought trail off.
He said, "We understand each other, son."
What does that mean?
I don't know. I think he was forgiving me.
Forgiving you?
He told me I shouldn't worry. Everything was going to be okay.
I'm floored.
How could he think you would do that? What did you say? I told him I didn't do it.
Paul hesitates.
I didn't know what else to say, so I told him what I found.
In the diary?
It's all I could think of. He seemed so worked up. He said he couldn't sleep. He was so worried.
Worried about what?
About me.
Look, I tell him, because I'm starting to hear it in his voice, the way Curry has affected him. He doesn't know what he's talking about.
If I'd known what you were going to do, I'd have done things differently. That's the last thing he said.
I want to lay into Curry, but I have to remind myself that the man who said these things is the closest thing Paul has to a father.
What did the detective say to you?
He asks, changing the subject. She tried to scare me.
She thought the same thing Richard did?
Yes. Did they try to get you to admit to it?
The dean came in before they could ask and told me not to answer questions.
What are you going to do?
She said I should find a lawyer.
He says it as if it would be easier to find a basilisk or a unicorn. We'll figure something out, I tell him. After I finish up the discharge paperwork, we head out. There's a police officer stationed near the entrance who eyes us as we begin walking toward him. A cold wind sets over us the second we step from the building. We begin the short walk back to campus on our own. The streets are empty, the sky is dimming, and now a bicycle passes by on the sidewalk, carrying a delivery man from a pizza shop. He leaves a trail of smells behind him, a cloud of yeast and steam, and as the wind picks up again, kicking snow into the air like dust, my stomach rumbles. A reminder that we're back among the living.
Come with me to the library, Paul says as we approach Nassau Street. I want to show you something.
He stops at the crosswalk. Beyond a white courtyard is Nassau Hall. I think of pant legs flapping from the cupola, of the clapper that wasn't there.
Show me what?
Paul's hands are in his pockets, and he walks with his head down, fighting the wind. We pass through FitzRandolph Gate, not looking back. You can walk through the gate into campus as often as you like, the legend goes, but if you walk out of it just once, you'll never graduate.
Vincent told me never to trust friends,
Paul says.
He said friends were fickle.
A tour guide leads a small group across our path. They look like carolers. Nathan FitzRandolph gave the land to build Nassau Hall, the tour guide says. He's buried where Holder Courtyard now stands.
I didn't know what to do when that pipe exploded. I didn't realize Charlie only went into the tunnels to find me.
We cross toward East Pine, heading for the library. In the distance sit the marble halls of the old debating societies. Whig, James Madison's club, and Cliosophic, Aaron Burr's. The tour guide's voice carries through the air behind us, and I have the growing sensation that I'm a visitor here, a tourist, that I've been walking down a tunnel in the dark since the first day I arrived at Princeton, the same way we did through the bowels of Holder Courtyard, surrounded by graves.
Then I heard you go after him. You didn't care what was down there. You just knew he was hurt.
Paul looks at me for the first time.
I could hear you calling for help, but I couldn't see anything. I was too scared to move. All I could think was, what kind of friend am I? I'm the fickle friend.
Paul, I say, stopping short, you don't have to do this. We're in the courtyard of East Pine, a building shaped like a cloister, where snow falls through the open quad in the middle. My father has returned to me unexpectedly, like a shadow on the walls, because I realize he walked these paths before I was born and saw these same buildings. I'm walking in his footsteps without even knowing it, because neither of us has made the faintest impression on this place. Paul turns, seeing me stop, and for a second, we're the only living things between these stone walls.
Yes, I do, he says, turning toward me. Because when I tell you what I found in the diary, everything else is going to seem small. And everything else isn't small. Just tell me if it's as big as we hoped.
Because if it is, then at least the shadow my father cast was a long one. Look forward, the physical therapist says between my ears, always forward. But now, as then, I'm surrounded by walls.
Yes, Paul says, knowing exactly what I mean. It is.
There's a spark in his face that brings those three words home, and I'm blown back again, struck by the very sensation I'd hoped to find. It's as if my father has pulled through something unthinkable, as if he's come back and been rehabilitated in a single stroke. I don't know what Paul's about to tell me, but the idea that it could be bigger than I imagined is enough to give me a feeling that's been missing for longer than I knew. It makes me look forward again, and actually see something in front of me, something other than a wall. It makes me feel hope.
Chapter 21.
On the way to Firestone, we pass Carrie Shaw, a junior I recognize from an English class last year, who crosses in front of us and says hi. She and I traded glances across the seminar table for weeks before I met Katie. I wonder how much has changed for her since then. I wonder if she can see how much has changed for me.
It seems like such an accident that I got sucked into the hypnerotomachia, Paul says as we continue heading east toward the library. Everything was so indirect, so coincidental, the same way it was for your dad.
Meeting McBee, you mean?
And Richard, what if they'd never known each other? What if they'd never taken that class together? What if I'd never picked up your dad's book?
We wouldn't be standing here. He takes it as a throwaway at first, then realizes what I mean. Without Curry and McBee and the Belladonna document, Paul and I would never have met. We would have crossed paths on campus the same way Carrie and I just did, saying hello, wondering where we'd seen each other before, thinking in a distant way what a shame it was that 4 years had passed and there were still so many unfamiliar faces.
Sometimes, he says, I ask myself, why did I have to meet Vincent? Why did I have to meet Bill? Why do I always have to take the long way to get where I'm going?
What do you mean?
Did you notice how the portmaster's directions don't get straight to the point either? 4 south, 10 east, 2 north, 6 west. They move in a big circle. You almost end up where you started.
Finally, I understand the connection. The wide sweep of circumstance. The way his journey with the Hypnerata Machia has wound through time and place. From 2 friends at Princeton in my father's day, to 3 men in New York, to a father and son in Italy, and back now to another 2 friends at Princeton. It all resembles Colonna's strange riddle, the directions that curl back on themselves.
Don't you think it makes sense that your father is the one that got me started on the Hypnerata Machia? Paul asks.
We arrive at the entrance, and Paul opens the library door for me as we duck in from the snow. We're in the old heart of campus now, a place made of stones. On summer days when cars streak by with their windows down and their radios up, and the whole student body wears shorts and t-shirts, buildings like Firestone and the Chapel and Nassau Hall seem like caves in a metropolis. But when the temperature drops and the snow falls, no place is more reassuring.
Last night, I started thinking, Paul continues. Francesco's friends helped him design the riddles, right? Now our friends are helping to solve them. You figured out the first one. Katie answered the second one. Charlie knew the last one. Your dad discovered the Belladonna document. Richard found the diary.
We pause at the turnstile, flashing our campus IDs to the guards at the gate. As we wait for the elevator to C floor, all the way to the bottom, Paul points to a metal plate on the elevator door. There's a symbol engraved on it that I've never noticed before.
The Aldine Press, I say, recognizing it from my father's old office at home.
Colonna's printer, Aldus Minucius, took his famous dolphin and anchor emblem, one of the most famous in printing history, from the Hypnerata Machia. Paul nods, and I sense this is part of his point. Everywhere he's turned in this 4-year spiral back toward the beginning, he's felt a hand at his back. His whole world, even in the silent details, has been nudging him on, helping him to crack Colonna's book. The elevator doors open, and we step in.
Anyway, I was thinking about all that last night, he says, pressing the button for C floor as we begin our descent. About how everything seemed to be coming full circle. And it hit me.
A bell dings above our heads, and the doors open onto the bleakest landscape of the library, dozens of feet underground. The ceiling-high bookshelves of C-floor are so tightly packed that they seem designed to shoulder the weight of the 5 floors above us. To our left is Microform Services, the dark grotto where professors and grad students huddle in clusters of microfilm machines, squinting at panels of light. Paul begins leading me through the stacks, running his finger along the dusty spines of books as we pass them. I realize he's taking me to his carrel.
There's a reason everything returns to where it started in this book. Beginnings are the key to the Hypnerata Machia. The first letter of every chapter creates the acrostic about Fra Francesco Colonna. The first letters of the architectural terms spell out the first riddle. It's not a coincidence that Francesco made everything come back to beginnings.
In the distance, I can see the long rows of green metallic doors, spaced almost as closely as high school lockers. The rooms they guard are no bigger than closets, but hundreds of seniors shut themselves inside for weeks on end to write their theses in peace. Paul's carrel, which I haven't seen in months, sits near the farthest corner.
Maybe I was just getting tired, but I thought, what if he knew exactly what he was doing? What if you could figure out how to decipher the second half of the book by focusing on something in the very first riddle? Francesco said he didn't leave any solutions, but he didn't say he left no hints. And I had the directions from the portmaster's diary to help me.
We arrive in front of his Carol, and he begins to twist the combination lock on the door. A sheet of black construction paper has been taped to the little rectangular window, making it impossible to see inside.
I thought the directions had to be about a physical location, how to get from a stadium to a crypt measured in stadia. Even the portmaster thought the directions were geographical.
He shakes his head. I wasn't thinking like Francesco. Paul opens the lock and swings the door wide. The little room is filled with books, piles upon piles of them, a tiny version of the president's room at Ivy. Food wrappers litter the floor. Sheets of paper are taped to the walls, thick as feathers, each one scrawled with a message.
Phineas, son of Belus, wasn't Phineas, king of Salmydessus, says one. Check Hesiod. Hesperithusa or Hesperia and Arethusa, says another. Buy more crackers, says a third.
I lift a stack of photocopies from one of the two chairs crammed into the carrel and try to sit down without knocking anything over.
So I came back to the riddles, he says. What was the first riddle about?
Moses, the Latin word for horns.
Right.
He turns his back to me to shut the door behind us.
It was about a mistranslation. Philology, historical linguistics, it was about language.
He begins searching through a column of books atop the hutch of his desk. Finally, he finds what he wants. Hart's History of Renaissance Art.
Why did we get lucky with the first riddle? He says.
Because I had that dream.
No,
he says, finding the page with Michelangelo's sculpture of Moses, the picture that began our partnership.
We got lucky because the riddle was about something verbal, and we were looking for something physical. Francesco didn't care about actual physical horns. He cared about a word, a mistranslation. We got lucky because that mistranslation eventually manifested itself physically. Michelangelo carved his Moses with horns, and you remembered that. If it hadn't been for the physical manifestation, we would never have found the linguistic answer. But that was the key. The words.
So you looked for a linguistic representation of the directions?
Exactly. North, south, east, and west aren't physical clues. They're verbal ones. When I looked at the second half of the book, I knew I was right. The word stadia shows up near the beginning of the very first chapter. Look,
he says, finding a sheet of paper where he's worked something out. There are three sentences written on the page. Gil and Charlie go to the stadium to watch Princeton versus Harvard. Tom waits as Paul catches up. Katie takes photographs while winsomely smiling and mouthing, I love you, Tom.
Winsomely? I say.
Doesn't look like much, right? It just sort of rambles like Poliphilo's story. But plot it out in a grid, he says, turning the piece of paper over, and you get this.
I'm waiting for something to jump out at me, but it doesn't.
That's it? I ask. That's it. Just follow the directions. 4 south, 10 east, 2 north, 6 west. De stadio, from stadium. Start with the S in stadium.
I find a pen on his desk and try it out, moving down 4, right 10, up 2, and left 6. I write down the letters S-O-L-U-T.
Then repeat the process, he says, starting with the last letter.
I begin again from T. And there it is, laid out on the page. S-O-L-U-T-I-O-N.
That's the rule of 4, Paul says. It's so simple once you understand how Colonna's mind works. 4 directions within the text. Just repeat it over and over again, then figure out where the word breaks are.
But it must have taken Colonna months to write. He nods.
The funny thing is, I'd always noticed there were certain lines in the Hypnerata Machia that seemed even more disorganized than others, places where words didn't really fit, where clauses were in strange places, where the weirdest neologisms turned up. It makes sense now. Francesco had to write the text to fit the pattern. It explains why he used so many languages.
if the vernacular word didn't fit in the spaces, he would have to try the Latin word or make one up himself. He even made a bad choice with the pattern. Look.
Paul points to the line where O, L, and N appear.
See how many cipher letters are on that one line? And there'll be another one once you go 6 west again. The 4 south, 2 north pattern doubles back on itself. So every other line in the Hypnerotomachia, Francesco had to find text that fit 4 different letters. But it worked. No one in 500 years picked up on it.
But the letters in the book aren't printed that way, I say, wondering how he applied the technique to the actual text. Letters aren't spaced evenly in a grid. How do you figure out what's exactly north or south? He nods.
You can't, because it's hard to say which letter is directly above or below another. I had to work it out mathematically instead of graphically.
It still amazes me, the way he teases simplicity and complexity out of the same idea.
Take what I wrote, for example. In this case, there are,
he counts something,
18 letters per line, right? If you work it out, that means 4 south will always be 4 lines straight down, which is the same as 72 letters to the right of the original starting point. Using the same math, 2 north will be the same as 36 letters to the left. Once you know the length of Francesco's standard line, you can just figure out the math and do everything that way. After a while, you get pretty quick at counting the letters.
In our partnership, it occurs to me, the only thing I ever had that could compare to the speed of Paul's reasoning was my intuition. Luck, dreams, chance associations. It hardly seems fair to him that we work together as equals. Paul folds the sheet of paper and places it in the trash can. For a second, he looks around the carrel, then lifts a stack of books and places it in the crook of my arm, followed by a stack for himself. The painkiller must still be working because my shoulder doesn't buckle under the heft.
I'm amazed you figured it out, I tell him. What did it say? Help me put these away, back on the shelves first, he answers. I want to empty this place out.
Why?
Just to be safe.
From what?
He half smiles at me. Library fines?
We exit the carrel, and Paul guides me toward a long corridor extending far into the darkness. There are bookshelves on either side, branching off into aisles of their own, dead ends begetting dead ends. We're in a corner of the library visited so rarely that the librarians keep the lights off, letting visitors flick the switch on each shelf when they come.
I couldn't believe it when I finished, he says. Even before I was through decoding, I was shaking. It was done. After all this time, done.
He stops at one of the rearmost shelves, and I can make out only the silhouette of his face.
Then it was worth it, Tom. I never even saw it coming, what was in the second half of the book. Remember what we saw in Bill's letter?
Yes.
Most of that letter was a lie. You know that work is mine, Tom. The most Bill ever did was translate a few Arabic characters. He made some copies and checked out some books. Everything else I did on my own.
I know, I say. Paul covers his mouth with his hand for a second.
That's not true. Without everything your father and Richard found, and everything the rest of you solved, you especially, I couldn't have done it. I didn't do it all on my own. The rest of you showed me the way.
Paul invokes my father's name and Richard Curry's as if they're a pair of saints, two martyrs from the paintings in Taft's lecture. For a moment, I feel like Sancho Panza listening to Don Quixote. The giants he sees are nothing but windmills, I know, and yet he's the one who sees clearly in the dark, and I'm the one doubting my eyes. Maybe that's been the rub all along, I think. We're animals of imagination. Only a man who sees giants can ever stand upon their shoulders.
But Bill was right about one thing, Paul says. The results will cast a shadow over everything else in historical studies. For a long time.
He takes the stack of books from my hands, and suddenly I feel weightless.
The corridor behind us extends toward a light in the distance, open aisles verging off into space on each side. Even in the darkness, I can see the way Paul smiles. Chapter 22. We begin making trips back and forth from the Carroll, replacing dozens of books, most of them on shelves where they don't belong. Paul only seems to care that they're out of sight.
"Do you remember what was going on in Italy just before the Hypnerotomachia was published?" he asks.
"Just what was in the Vatican tour book." Paul lifts another pile of books into my arms as we walk back into the darkness.
"The intellectual life of Italy during Francesco's day revolves around a single city," he says.
"Rome." But Paul shakes his head.
"Smaller than that. The size of Princeton. The campus, not the town."
I see how enchanted he is by what he's found, how real it's become for him already.
"In that town," he says, "you've got more intellectuals than anyone knows what to do with. Geniuses, polymaths, thinkers who are gunning for the big answers to the big questions. Autodidacts who've taught themselves ancient languages no one else knows. Philosophers who are combining religious points from the Bible with ideas from Greek and Roman texts. Egyptian mysticism, Persian manuscripts so old nobody knows how to date them. The absolute cutting edge of humanism. Think of the riddles. University professors playing Rhythmomachia. Translators interpreting Horapollo. Anatomists revising Galen."
In my mind's eye, the dome of Santa Maria del Fiore comes into focus. My father liked to call it the mother city of modern scholarship.
"Florence," I say. "Right, but that's only the beginning. In every other discipline, you've got the biggest names in Europe. In architecture, you've got Brunelleschi, who engineered the largest cathedral dome in 1,000 years. In sculpture, you've got Ghiberti, who created a set of reliefs so beautiful that they're known as the Doors of Paradise. And you've got Ghiberti's assistant, who grows up to become the father of modern sculpture, Donatello."
"The painters weren't bad either," I remind him. Paul smiles.
"The single greatest concentration of genius in the history of Western art, all in this little town. Applying new techniques, inventing new theories of perspective, transforming painting from a craft into a science and an art. There must have been 36 of them, like Alberti, who would have been considered first class anywhere else in the world. But in this town, they're second rate. That's because they're competing with the giants, Masaccio, Botticelli, Michelangelo."
As the momentum of his ideas increases, his feet move faster down the dark hallways.
"You want scientists?" he says. "How about Leonardo da Vinci? You want politicians? Machiavelli. Poets? Boccaccio and Dante. And a lot of these guys were contemporaries. On top of it all, you have the Medici, a family so rich it could afford to patronize as many artists and intellectuals as the town could produce. All of them, together in that same small city at basically the same time. The greatest cultural heroes in all of Western history. Crossing each other in the streets. Knowing each other on a first-name basis. Talking to each other, working together. Competing, influencing, and pushing each other to go further than they could have gone alone. All in a place where beauty and truth are king. Where leading families fight over who can commission the greatest art. Who can subsidize the most brilliant thinkers. Who can own the biggest library. Imagine that. All of that. It's like a dream. An impossibility."
We return to his carrel, and he finally takes a seat.
"Then, in the last few years of the 15th century, just before the Hypnerotomachia is written, something even more amazing happens. Something that every Renaissance scholar knows about, but that no one